I'm Taylor.
I'm Kat.
And welcome to Square Mile of Murder. Welcome back, actually, because this is the second and final part of our episode on Soviet serial killer Andrei Chikatilo. So, on with the show. Just like we said last week, might want to skip out on eating during this episode. Maybe find something fuzzy to cuddle. Hug your family if you are able in this socially distanced reality that we live in. But it's going to be rough, so welcome.
Yeah. We left off last week in December 1982, when Chikatilo had just taken his ninth victim, 10-year-old Olga Stalmakhinok, I think. Chikatilo didn't kill again until the summer of 1983, but whilst he was on this break, kind of laying low, the police were actually beginning to make a bit of headway in the investigation. So, as we mentioned last week, the concept of a serial killer was considered literally to be a foreign construct in the Soviet Union. It was a capitalist thing and it didn't exist in the Soviet Union, in communist society.
Mm-hmm.
But police finally had to admit that these murders showed so many similarities in both the level of brutality and the way they were carried out. For example, the striations to the eyes, that they had to admit that they...
I'm losing my voice.
All right, I'm just going to start that again. So, as we mentioned last week, serial killers were considered to literally be a foreign construct in the Soviet Union. They were a product of a capitalist society and didn't exist in communist countries. But police finally had to admit that these murders might be linked because they showed so many similarities in both the level of brutality and the way they were carried out. You know, for example, the striations to the eyes, which was seen in pretty much every one of Chikatilo's victims.
Mm-hmm.
So four of the murders were linked. So that's four that were found around the city of Rostov-on-Don. And in January 1983, a Moscow investigation team was drafted into Rostov to help the local law enforcement. So the team was headed up by Mikhail Fetisov, and the investigation eventually became known as Operation Forest Path. And in March, Fetisov brought in a forensic analyst called Viktor Burakov to lead the investigation. And the following month, so the April, Olga's body was finally discovered and linked to the other victims. So by now they'd linked five of Chikatilo's nine victims together.
Mm-hmm. So due to the sheer brutality of the murders and the way some of the internal organs were removed, police began to theorize that they were searching for either a group that was harvesting organs to sell on the black market for transplant, a satanic cult, a pedophile, or a group of people with mental health issues. Like we talked about last week, people with mental health problems weren't treated kindly by authorities in the Soviet Union. Law enforcement focused mostly on the theory that a pedophile, a homosexual, or a mentally ill person or persons were responsible for the murders.
Yeah, because it's also worth noting that in the Soviet Union, as in modern Russia, homophobia was...
rampant.
Yeah, that's the word. And
violent.
Homosexuality was treated as a sort of like a mental health...
yes.
Disease.
Yeah. A deficiency.
If that's the right word. Yeah.
Yeah. So. Yeah. So that's what they're focusing on. The investigation was actually quite thorough, even though they were looking, you know, in the wrong places. And although this investigation didn't find Chikatilo, they did manage to solve more than 1,000 unrelated violent crimes, including 95 murders and 245 rapes, which is a lot of crimes.
Yeah. And I mean, they did this a lot by, like, flipping suspects, essentially turning them into informants. And we say solved doesn't mean they solved them in the, like, doesn't mean they got the right person. It meant that the cases were closed and someone was in prison or, you know, sentenced to death for the crimes.
Yeah.
Law enforcement's heavy-handed tactics weren't without their casualties.
Of course not.
In September 1983, a number of youths who were considered to be, quote, intellectually disabled were subjected to prolonged and brutal interrogations and ended up confessing to the murders, which, you know, fitted the police theory that it could be a group of disabled or mentally unwell people. But as the bodies of more and more young people were found after the confessions, law enforcement realized it couldn't be these youths murdering them. Three homosexual men and at least one registered sex offender ended their own lives as a result of police interrogation. But while law enforcement were looking in all the wrong places, Chikatilo had been on another spree. Between June and December 1983, he killed Laura Sarkisian, who was 15, 13-year-old Irina Dunakova, Yudmila Kutsibeyer, who was 24, Igor Gudkov, who was 7, a woman who has still not been identified who was believed to be between the ages of 18 and 25, 22-year-old Valentina Chukulina, Vera Shakun, who was 19, and Sergei Markov, who was 14.
So the murder of 15-year-old Laura Sarkisian is contested. Because she's listed as one of Chikatilo's victims, but he was ultimately cleared of her murder at his trial. The unidentified woman listed as one of Chikatilo's victims was a woman he claimed to meet in Novoshakhtinsk. Her body was found in October 1983, but she was never identified. Chikatilo killed again in January and February of 1984, murdering 17-year-old Natalia Shalapinina on January 9th and 44-year-old Marta Ryabenko on February 21st. Both were murdered in Aviators Park in the city of Rostov. Also, just a note again, we're so sorry for the pronunciation, but we don't speak any sort of...
We're trying our best.
Yeah. Right. So Marta was the oldest of Chikatilo's victims. So she was 44. On March 24th, he killed 10-year-old Dmitry Potashnikov after luring him away from a stamp kiosk in Novoshakhtinsk. There were several witnesses who saw Chikatilo with Dmitry who were able to give a detailed description of the killer. And when the young boy's body was found 3 days later, police also found a footprint nearby. And semen and saliva samples were found on the boy's clothing. In late May, Chikatilo killed 29-year-old Tatiana Petrosian and her 10-year-old daughter Svetlana in Shakhty. Tatiana had reportedly known Chikatilo since 1978 when he and his family had lived in Shakhty. And in June and July, Chikatilo killed 4 more times. 21-year-old Yelena Bakulina, 13-year-old Dmitry Ilarionov, a 19-year-old Anna Lemesheva, and 20-year-old Sarmite Sana.
In the summer of 1984, Chikatilo was fired from his job as a supply clerk for stealing a roll of linoleum.
What a boring theft.
I know, right?
He stole floor.
I mean, do you really need to redo your kitchen floor that badly? That you've got to steal it from work?
Right.
The accusation had actually been brought about in the February, and he had been asked to quietly resign, but he refused. So the company investigated him and finally got around to firing him in the summer. But on August 1st, he found another supply clerk job at another factory in Rostov, which once again meant that he had to travel all around the Soviet Union. And just one day after starting his new job, Chikatilo killed Natalia Golosovskaya, who was 16, in Aviators Park in Rostov. And less than a week later, he killed 17-year-old Lyudmila Alexeyeva after offering her directions to Rostov bus terminal. Days later, he was on a business trip to Soviet Uzbek, which is now Uzbekistan, and he murdered another woman, but she again has never been identified, but she was estimated to be between the ages of 20 and 25, and that's all we know about her. He committed a second murder whilst on this business trip, this time in the Uzbek capital of Tashkent. 10-year-old Akmaral Seydalieva was a runaway from Kazakhstan. 10 years old and a runaway.
I know.
And I know, obviously, the border situation is different then because it's all one, you know, it's the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
But Kazakhstan's a big country.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And to run away and get as far as
Uzbekistan,
as the Uzbek capital is.
Yeah.
It's just so sad.
It is. It's horrible. Amongst all of the other horrible things happening in the story, like it's layers. It's an onion full of horrible.
Yeah.
That's what this episode is. So glad you're listening, aren't you?
Yeah. So just a nice like 10-second palate cleanser.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, I don't know if you remember, so I think it was like the first year that we would have lived in Glasgow. Someone was giving out chocolate apples at Halloween. They were actually chocolate onions. They were like dipping onions in chocolate and giving them to the kids.
Oh no. Oh. That would
be onion full,
an unpleasant surprise.
Onion of
sorrow.
I mean, don't get me wrong, I love onion. It is one of my favorite vegetables.
Same.
Put it in everything. But if I think I'm getting a chocolate apple, I don't want to bite in and find an onion.
You don't want to. No. No one wants that. Absolutely no one. So after returning to Rostov, Chikatilo murdered 11-year-old Alexander Chappell on the bank of the River Don on August 28th. And less than 2 weeks later, on September 6th, he murdered 24-year-old librarian Irina Luchinskaya. She disappeared on her way to a sauna and was found in Aviators Park. Then Chikatilo went quiet for 11 months, but not entirely of his own volition. On September 13th, undercover detectives spotted him trying to talk to girls at the Rostov bus station. So these detectives followed him through the city and witnessed him trying to talk to numerous women and saw him commit acts of frauderism in public places. And if one is not familiar, frauderism is the act of rubbing one's pelvic region or erect penis against another person in a non-consensual act for sexual pleasure. Lovely. So he was arrested at Rostov's Central Market, and during a search of his belongings, he was found to be in a possession of an 8-inch knife, or 20 centimeters, several lengths of rope, and a jar of Vaseline.
It's the Vaseline that freaks me out.
Yep. Yep.
Law enforcement officers discovered that he had been fired from his previous job for theft, and so they applied to hold him for longer than the usual period whilst they continue to investigate him. The usual period is 10 days. It's yeah. not like here, where it's, is it 48 hours?
Yeah, something like that.
They discovered his checkered history.
Putting it nicely. Shall we say,
when it came to employment, and he matched the eyewitness descriptions of the man seen leading Dmitry Pteshnikov away from the stamp kiosk. So a sample of Chikatilo's blood was taken, which you would think would match the samples at the crime scenes and it would all be over. Alas, not.
You'd be wrong.
At this point in the 1980s, they were only able to carry out blood group typing, not a full DNA profile. And Chikatilo's blood was type A. And this didn't match the type AB semen samples, which had been recovered from 6 of the victims. Now, this is because Chikatilo was a non-secretor, which means that his blood type didn't match the typing found in other bodily fluids such as semen and saliva. Chikatilo was largely discounted as being this, you know, forest path unknown serial killer because the blood types didn't match. But his name was added to the investigators' files and it was recorded that he had been, you know, questioned and blood typed and everything in relation to this, to the killings.
Mm-hmm.
He was found guilty of the theft from his previous employer and sentenced to 1 year in prison, but he served just under 3 months and was released on December 12th, 1984. Whilst he was in prison, the head of public prosecutor's office formally linked Chikatilo to what at this point was 23 murders, which had so far been linked to this one unknown serial killer. So all charges were dropped against the group of youths with special educational needs on October 8th. There were, however, still 10 murders which hadn't been linked to the serial killer.
So when we say here that Chikatilo was formally linked to the 23 murders, does that mean that, like, they knew he was...
He was an official suspect.
Okay. They weren't sitting there like, this guy definitely did it.
No. They kind of had him as an official suspect, but they couldn't really do anything because the blood samples didn't match and they didn't have
mm-hmm.
any more
information.
Like anything concrete.
Yeah.
At this point.
Okay. So that makes sense. I was like, well, if they knew he did it, then just go get him. All right, so upon his release from prison, Chikatilo found work again as a supply clerk, this time at a locomotive factory in Novoshakhtinsk. And once again, this job allowed him to travel across the Soviet Union. But Chikatilo kept a low profile for a few months and didn't kill again until August 1st, 1985. So on a business trip to the Moscow Oblast, Chikatilo met 18-year-old Natalia Poklistova at a railway station near Domodedovo Airport.
I like that name because it's like consonant vowel, consonant vowel, yeah. consonant vowel.
Oh, it is. It's very...
So you can sound it out quite easily.
Domodedovo. That's about 25 miles southeast of Moscow. He lured her away from the station platform into a wooded area and stabbed her 38 times, then strangled her and further mutilated her body. Remember that the team who were guiding the investigation in Rostov were originally from Moscow. So when they heard of Natalia's murder, they linked it to the killer that they were hunting in the Rostov Oblast. And investigators theorized that Since the murder had taken place near the airport and Natalia had last been seen at the station near the airport, the murderer must have flown from Rostov to Moscow. So they checked flight manifests and all records that were available for passengers who had flown from Rostov to Moscow between late July and early August, and ran down the names and leads that came from the passenger information. But nothing came of it. Because on this particular occasion, Chikatilo had traveled to Moscow by train, and there were no passenger records for trains like there were for airlines. So investigators had no idea that Chikatilo had been in Moscow at the time of Natalia's murder.
That is, like, obviously this whole thing is just one big onion of awfulness, as we have said. But they were actually doing a really thorough job of investigating, which isn't something we say often about police.
Yeah, and, like, it's quite a good, like, catch to say, like, oh, well, it sounds like this is the same guy from Rostov. This victim was seen at the airport or near the airport or whatever. I bet this guy went from Rostov to Moscow. Like, that's some good, yeah, like, deductive reasoning there.
Yeah. 4 weeks later, Chikatilo struck again, this time in the city of Shakhty, when he lured 18-year-old Irina Gulieva from the bus station into a nearby wooded area where he brutally murdered her. The violent wounds found on Irina's body linked her to the other victims of this unknown serial killer, who by now they were referring to as the Forest Path Killer, because most of the victims were being found in wooded areas.
Mm.
So following Irina's murder, Chikatilo would take another break, and he kept a low profile for almost 2 years.
Oh.
Now, this might have been due to the fact in November 1985, Special Procurator Isa Kostoyev was assigned to supervise the investigation. At this point in late 1985, 25 detectives and 15 procurators were working exclusively on the case. And if you're like me and don't know what a procurator is and can barely say the word, it is a representative from the courts. So I think it's similar to like a district attorney type of role.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like.
Yeah. All of the Forest Path murders were reinvestigated. Once again, registered sex offenders and known homosexuals were interrogated.
I just love the phrase known homosexuals. It's like,
yeah,
I am a known homosexual.
This wasn't the biggest change in the investigation. So Viktor Borokov, the forensic investigator who'd been brought in to lead the investigation, brought in a forensic psychologist called Dr. Alexander Bukhanovsky. And this was the first time that a serial killer investigation had consulted a psychiatrist in the Soviet Union.
That's cool. I mean,
partly because they didn't believe in serial killers, but from time to time they did have to admit that they existed. So all of the investigation files were made available to Dr. Bukhanovsky, and he produced a 65-page long psychological profile.
Damn, son.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, we do not have the time, or the patience for that matter, to go through the entire 65-page profile here, but we will give you the basics. So.
The highlight reel.
Yeah, the summary, the cliff notes. Spark Notes version. So Dr. Bukhanovsky's profile proposed that the killer would be a reclusive man, age 45 to 50 years old, who had suffered a traumatic and isolated childhood. The man would be of average intelligence and would likely be married with children, although he would have trouble communicating, flirting with, or dating women. His wife likely just let him get on with his life and didn't interfere, and probably didn't know anything about the murders. He would be a sadist who suffered with impotence and could only achieve sexual arousal by inflicting suffering upon his victims. The murders were an analog for the sexual intercourse the murderer was incapable of performing, and thus the use of a knife became a substitute for his penis, which failed to function. Dr. Bukhanovsky also posited that as most of the murders in Rostov-on-Don had been committed on weekends, and those elsewhere in the Rostov Oblast were often committed during the week near major transport hubs, the killer likely had a job which required him to travel.
And now you see why we went into so much detail last week about Chikatilo's upbringing and early life.
Yeah.
Because this profile was spot on.
It was perfect.
Chikatilo literally fit all of the main criteria. And he also followed the investigation quite closely. So the police, who were actually called the Militsiya in Soviet times, you know, haven't done much history this episode, so you know.
Yeah, you got to get some in there.
Yeah. So the Militsiya resumed surveillance of train stations around Rostov. Female officers in plain clothes would hang around the stations in an attempt to attract the killer. No murders were linked to the Forest Path killer in nearly 2 years. The murder of 33-year-old Lyubov Golovikar in Myasnikovsky district of Rostov on the 23rd of July 1986 was tentatively linked, mainly because the semen type matched that found on the serial killers of the victims, but was eventually discounted as her murder did not exhibit the same level of brutality that Chikatilo's victims did. In August 1986, the body of 18-year-old Irina Pogolyova was found in the city of Bateysk, which is about 10 miles away from Rostov-on-Don. We are not going to describe her injuries because they are horrific. The details are out there on the internet, if you so wish to read about them. But suffice it to say that she was horrifically murdered. Her body bore all the injuries that were associated with the Forest Path killer. But despite this, she's not listed as a confirmed victim due to the fact that Chikatilo confessed and retracted his confession to her murder multiple times during his trial, well, after his arrest and trial, and it couldn't be proven that he killed her. So
with no more murders in Rostov in 1986, investigators theorized that the murderer may have moved to another part of the Soviet Union. They sent bulletins to law enforcement all over the Soviet Union describing the murders, the injuries, victimology, and psychological profile, asking that the departments contact them if there was a murder that matched the Forest Path killer. But they received no responses. So Chikatilo began killing again in May 1987, but the three murders he committed in 1987 were all committed while he was away on business nowhere near Rostov. 12-year-old Oleg Makarenkov was murdered on May 16th. He was a boarding school student in Revda in the Sverdlovsk Oblast, which is in the Urals, and is where the city of Yekaterinburg is, if that helps anyone. It doesn't help me, but...
I know it's quite a famous city as...
Okay.
Well, outside of, like, Moscow, St. Petersburg, and Vladivostok, nobody knows cities in Russia, do they? But I know that Yekaterinburg is quite well known. It's quite historic. Okay. Uh-huh. So it's like, if that helps anyone, it's kind of there.
Good luck with the Russian geography. It's over. Yeah. It's over my head. I'm going to need to look at a map after we finish recording this one, I think. So his body wasn't found until years later when Chikatilo had been arrested, and he actually led detectives to Oleg's body. On July 29th, Chikatilo killed 12-year-old Ivan Bilovsky in a wooded area by a railway line in the city of Zaporizhia in Soviet Ukraine. Ivan's own father found his body the next day. And 6 weeks later, Chikatilo traveled to St. Petersburg, or Leningrad, as it was called in the 1980s, where he murdered 16-year-old vocational student Yuri Tereshchonok after luring him off the train. Like Oleg, Yuri wasn't found until years later when Chikatilo led law enforcement to his body following his arrest.
Chikatilo laid low for 7 months following Yuri's murder, but in April 1988, he murdered a woman who is still unidentified. She was estimated to be aged between 22 and 28 and was found outside a metals factory in Krasny Sulin in the Rostov Oblast. Investigators noted the similarities between her murder and the Forest Path victims, but there were significant differences in the way she was killed, as she died from blunt force trauma to the head rather than stab wounds or strangulation, and there was no disembowelment or removal of organs, as was seen in most of the Forest Path victims, and as a result, they weren't sure whether or not to include her in the list of the Forest Path killer's victims. The following month, he travelled to Soviet Ukraine for work, and on May 15th, he murdered 9-year-old Alexei Voronoko in Atomivsk, which is now known as Bakhmut. Some say, so there's differences for this one, so some sources say it was a city of Ilovaisk. But we're not sure. But both those cities are in the Donetsk Oblast in eastern Ukraine. So
somewhere around there then.
Yeah, it was in eastern Ukraine.
Yeah.
In July, Chikatilo killed in the Rostov-on-Don area for the first time in 3 years. So on July 14th, Chikatilo murdered 15-year-old Yevgeny Muratov near the Donleshkoz railway station. His body wouldn't be found until the following April, by which time the remains were mostly skeletal, but he was still quickly linked to the Forest Path murders because the extensive stab wounds and other injuries were evident on the bones. We're trying not to be too graphic with these descriptions, yeah, because we would rather, you know, honour the victims by naming them than going into detail about what happened to a few of them.
Yeah.
But
it's all bad.
Yeah. Yeah. The violence was that extensive that it was evident on the bones.
On the bones. Yeah. So Chikatilo didn't kill again until March 1989, when he murdered 16-year-old Tatiana Ryshova. She was a runaway from Krasny Sulin, but unlike his previous victims, Chikatilo this time killed in his daughter's apartment rather than outside. He hid Tatiana's body in a sewer, and she was found 8 days later on March 9th. But police didn't link her to the Forest Path killer. On May 11th, he killed 8-year-old Alexander Diakonov in a wooded area of Rostov-on-Don. In July, he murdered 10-year-old Oleski Moiseev. And following his arrest, Chikatilo described Alexei as a boy from Kolchugno in the Vladimir Oblast, whom he took from the beach into the forest. And he was not linked to the Forest Path investigation either. The third victim of 1989 was 19-year-old student Yelena Varga. She was originally from Hungary, and Chikatilo lured her off a bus and killed her in a village just outside of Rostov-on-Don on August 19th. So on August 28th, he murdered 10-year-old Oleski Kobotov, after meeting him near a theater in Shakti. He buried the boy in a shallow grave, and he was only found when Chikatilo confessed following his arrest and led police to the gravesite.
With the reemergence of the Forest Path Killer in the Rostov area, police once again stepped up their surveillance operations now that they knew the killer was active in the area again. So local trains were fitted with security cameras, plainclothes officers travelled on the trains. They filmed and photographed passengers in the hopes that if another victim turned up, they would have been seen in the company of the killer on a train. Once again, Chikatilo kept a low profile for a while when the investigation got ramped up. That was until January 14th, 1990, when he abducted 11-year-old Andrei Kravchenko from his home in Shakhty. His body was found a month later in a wooded area of Shakhty. That is interesting because that's the first time he's taken someone from a home.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I was just going to say it's maybe in sort of response to the sort of increased surveillance on the trains.
Yeah.
If he is following the investigation and he is traveling around a lot, he probably, you know, so it is possible that he realized, oh, these people are always on this train. They're maybe they're just not quite surreptitious enough in taking pictures, or, you know, anything could have happened where he just happened to notice or realize that they were undercover officers and kind of, right, okay, we'll avoid picking people up on the train for now.
Yeah. Well, and also, like, it almost seems like he's changing things up a bit, and I don't know if it's like an escalation necessarily, but I feel like he's getting more brazen. Like he's abducting someone from their home. He killed someone in his daughter's apartment. Like,
yeah. I wonder if it's, like you say, it's definitely more brazen. It's like almost like a confidence thing as well. Like,
yeah. It's so, like, well, I've gotten away with this many.
Yeah. It could be like, oh, well, I can get away with it because they can't catch me. Or on the other hand, it could be avoiding the public transport to avoid or try and avoid undercover officers if he's like caught them, but we don't know.
It's interesting.
Yeah. On March 8th, 10-year-old Yaroslav Makarov was playing truant from school when he met Chikatilo at a Rostov train station. Chikatilo lured the boy to Rostov Botanical Gardens, and his body was found there the following day. Just 2 days after Yaroslav's body was discovered, the leaders of the Forest Path investigation held a meeting to discuss the case. Head of the case, Mikhail Fetisov, was under enormous public pressure from interior ministers in Moscow, because the case had now been ongoing for 6 years. And although thousands of other cases had now been solved, they were seemingly no closer to finding the Forest Path Killer. And by 1990, there is a much greater freedom of the press inside the Soviet Union than there had been under sort of previous Soviet leaders, who had sort of massively suppressed the media and what they could report on, and everything had to be like state-sanctioned. And so, you know, a serial killer, this Forest Path Killer, is like perfect tabloid fodder for a newly freed press. Quite sadly, but it's just the way the public operate.
Yeah. So in 1990, Gorbachev was in office, wasn't he?
Yes.
So
yeah,
that's a little sort of context, if that helps you
think
about it at all.
Speak more about Gorbachev in later on as well, because a few interesting things happen in the next year or so.
Just a few. Chikatilo killed 3 more times between March and August of 1990. In April, he was traveling from Novocherkassk to Shakti when he met 31-year-old Loibov Zuyeva. Her body was found in the woodlands near the Donleshkov station. In July, he lured 13-year-old Viktor Petrov from the Rostov Glavny train station where his family were waiting for a train, and murdered him in Rostov Botanical Gardens, just meters from where he had killed Yaroslav Makarov in March of that year. In August, he murdered 11-year-old Ivan Fomin at a municipal beach in Novocherkassk when the boy entered a thicket to change his clothes. The discovery of these bodies sparked a huge police operation. As many victims had been discovered along a single route through the Rostov Oblast, Viktor Burakov, who was leading the investigation alongside Mikhail Fedosov, suggested that they flood the main stations with uniformed officers, so much so that the killer couldn't fail to notice the heavy police presence, and the smaller, less populated stations would be surveilled by undercover plainclothes officers with the aim of forcing the murderer to the smaller stations where it'd be easier to spot and apprehend him.
This operation began on October 27th, 1990. 360 uniformed officers were deployed to the main train stations, but only three of the smaller stations were surveilled by undercover officers. So that was Kapiknaya, Donleshoz, and Liostep, as these were the main areas where the killer had struck. 3 days later, the body of 16-year-old Vadim Gromov was found near the Donleshoz station. Vadim was a student from Shakti who was travelling by train to Taganrog when Chikatilo had lured him off the train. It was later determined that he had been killed on October 17th, which is 10 days before the operation began.
Oh.
Yeah. The same day that Vadim's body was found, so that's October 30th, Chikatilo struck again. He lured a 16-year-old Viktor Tshenko from a train at the Kaprikinia station, which is in Shakti. I don't think we mentioned that before, that's the name of the station in Shakti. So Viktor left the station with Chikatilo, even though the station was under surveillance by undercover officers, and Chikatilo murdered him in the nearby forest. But Viktor fought hard, really fought for his life, and he broke Chikatilo's finger and bit him, like very severe, deep bites. And he is the only victim that we know of to actually injure Chikatilo. Do you think mostly he went for younger children, or he went for women mm-hmm. and girls who, sadly, he could easily overpower? Viktor's body was found on November 3rd.
So on November 6th, 1990, Chikatilo murdered 22-year-old Svetlana Korostik in the woodlands near Donleshkov station, which was under surveillance. Can't say any words anymore. God. So she was Chikatilo's 53rd and final victim. When he returned to the station, undercover officer Igor Rybakov spotted him and became suspicious. Chikatilo was approaching a well to wash his hands and face. And Igor, or Igor?
I would say Igor, but I don't know if that's right.
Igor, or possibly Igor, noticed that Chikatilo had a red smear on his cheek, a severe wound to his finger, and he also had soil stains on his clothes and shoes. And the only reason people usually went into the woods in this area was to pick mushrooms, which was apparently a popular pastime in that area of the Soviet Union. Weirdly enough, I have heard that before. So checks out.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so it's popular to pick mushrooms in the area, but Chikatilo wasn't dressed for walking and scavenging in the woods, and nor did he have a suitable bag for collecting mushrooms. What makes a bag suitable for that purpose?
I don't know. It was just mentioned in one of the sources was that...
Good drainage bag, or like...
I don't know. I think it's like, you know, like a plastic bag of some description, and he had like a, you know, like a fabric bag, I think it was.
Right. So he did not have a suitable mushroom bag. So, Igor stopped Chikatilo and checked his papers. He didn't really have any reason to detain Chikatilo, so he let him go. But when he returned to his office, he filed in a routine report saying he had stopped Chikatilo, noting the possible blood smear on his cheek and his suspicious nature.
A week later, on November 13th, Svetlana's body was found in the woodland area near Donleshoz station. At the time, she was the 36th victim to be linked to the forest path killer, even though she was actually Chikatilo's 53rd victim. The police summoned Igor, and the other officers who were manning that station and examined their reports, who they'd stopped, what had been going on, all that kind of thing throughout the previous week. And would you know it? Andrei Chikatilo's name came up.
Shocking.
So many officers were already familiar with him after his arrest in 1984. And he'd also been placed on the, you know, official suspect list. More than once, actually. I think when the sort of reinvestigation began in 1987, he was placed on the list again. But there'd never been anything to definitively link him to the murders. So police very quickly interviewed Chikatilo's former colleagues and employers and found out about his history of sexual assault whilst working in schools. So he was placed under surveillance the next day on November 14th. He was followed for 6 days on trains and buses where he was frequently seen trying to engage children and young women in conversation. If they ignored him or brushed him off, he would wait a few minutes and then move on to a new target.
So, on November 20th, he traveled to Novochurkask. He had left his house with a large jar, which he filled with beer at a small kiosk in a park. He wandered around the town, attempting to make conversation with children. He spent some time in a cafe, and upon leaving the cafe, he was arrested by plainclothes officers. Chikatilo protested his innocence. He was placed in a cell at the KGB headquarters in Rostov with a police informer who was tasked with engaging Chikatilo in conversation and reporting back anything that he said. His questioning began the next day, led by Isa Kostoyev, the special procurator who had been brought in to assist the investigation in 1985. The strategy chosen by investigators was to try and lead Chikatilo to believe he was a sick person in need of medical help and elicit a confession that way. They hoped that this would give Chikatilo hope that he would not be prosecuted by reason of insanity and therefore more forthcoming with details and hopefully a confession.
The case was largely circumstantial at this point, and law enforcement knew that they had 10 days to hold Chikatilo before either charging or releasing him. When he was arrested, a blood sample had been taken again, but it came back as type A, you know, because that's what the first test came back as 6 years earlier. But there was so much circumstantial evidence that Chikatilo was the murderer that investigators weren't letting him go easily again. So they managed to obtain a sample of his semen to test. Do not ask, we don't know how they got it. You can't get a warrant for a semen sample. It's not a thing. We don't know how they got it. And this is when they found out that his blood type didn't match with the type found in other bodily fluids. because his semen was type AB, which matched that matched samples that had been found on 14 of the victims. So throughout his questioning with Isa Kostoyev, Chikatilo denied the murders, although he did confess to sexually assaulting his students during his teaching career. He also wrote a number of essays, which didn't really do anything in terms of a confession, but they did reveal sort of psychological symptoms that were consistent with Dr. Bukhanovsky's profile.
On November 29th, Mikhail Fedosov and Viktor Burakov invited Dr. Bukhanovsky to help them question Chikatilo. It was reported that within 2 hours of Dr. Bukhanovsky joining the questioning, Chikatilo burst into tears and confessed to the murders for which he had been arrested. So that is the 36 Forest Path murders. There are still 17 others who either hadn't been linked or hadn't been found yet. The following morning, Chikatilo confessed to 34 of the 36 murders when Isa Kostoyev resumed questioning. He denied murdering Loibov Golovaka and Irina Pogrilova in the summer of 1986. Chikatilo gave a full account of each of the murders on the list, other than those two that he denied. He drew some crime scenes and described the positions of the victims' bodies. He also recalled local landmarks near each murder site. Chikatilo also confessed to cannibalizing some of his victims. But we're not going to go into detail about that because this episode is already bad enough.
Yeah. I mean, when I got to this part of the script, I did have a kind of thought. I was like, oh my God, everyone is going to hate us. This is such a really heavy script. But I was like, it is important to honor all the victims. And
absolutely.
As we say, if you want to find more details, they are out there on the internet. We just don't want to. Well, we don't have the time, firstly, to explain everything he did to every victim, but it's not something we want to talk about either.
And it's not relevant, I think. Well, like,
no.
I don't know. Relevant is maybe the right word. It's not pertinent because, like, ultimately, we want to tell the story and sort of the general happenings of his crimes. And we want to make sure that we highlight who his victims were.
Yeah.
I don't really care what his sort of criminal proclivities were. Yeah, he's a shithead.
Yeah. Very nicely put.
Thank you.
So on November 30th, 1990, Chikatilo was formally charged with the 34 murders he had confessed to. But in the following days, he confessed to a further 22 murders, which hadn't been linked to the Forest Path murders. So, as with the Forest Path murders, he was able to recall details of each of the murders. And that month, he was able to lead police to some of his undiscovered victims. Three of the victims couldn't be located or identified, and so Chikatilo was ultimately charged with 53 murders, spanning 1978 to 1990. He was held in his cell in the KGB building in Rostov to await his trial. I've been thinking about this, so this is not to say that those three victims were invented. So yeah, before we get to the trial, we have to talk about something pretty incredible that happened in 1991. And no, it is not the births of both me and Taylor. As awesome as that is.
Yeah, that's pretty great. It's pretty great. But it's not that.
No. On December 26, 1991, Mikhail Gorbachev, the eighth and final leader of the USSR, formally dissolved the Soviet Union. And the nations which had made up the Soviet Union were now independent, with Russia being recognized as kind of the de facto successor to the Soviet Union, and all the other countries had their independence. So Chikatilo's trial would become the first major media event in post-Soviet Russia. And that is also why we know so much about Chikatilo, because not only had the press in Russia gained a lot of freedom throughout the 80s during Gorbachev's time as president. Were they presidents? Whatever they called their leader.
Yeah. It was both like leader of the Soviet Union, but he was also known as the president of the Soviet Union.
Yeah. So yeah, during his presidency, see, more and more freedoms had been gained. And then with the dissolution of the Soviet Union in 91, suddenly all the world had access to Russian media and was able to keep up with current events and internal affairs in Russia. And with Chikatilo's trial scheduled for April 1992, like 4 months later, the world's media was like captivated. It's a bit like when the press gained freedoms and they suddenly had this, you know, this really sensationalist, horrible serial killer that they could write about. It's a bit like that on the world stage as well. Because Russia had been closed off for decades. And suddenly, like, the world had access to this country again. And lo and behold, this huge, massive trial is about to happen.
Yeah, quite an entry onto the world stage.
Yeah.
So in the summer of 1991, Chikatilo had undergone a 60-day psychiatric evaluation. He was diagnosed with borderline personality disorder with sadistic features, and it was noted that he had physiological problems which were attributed to prenatal brain damage. But ultimately, he was found fit to stand trial. So on April 14th, 1992, Chikatilo's trial began in courtroom number 5 of the Rostov Provincial Court. He was charged with 53 murders and 5 counts of sexual assault against minors from his teaching days. Now, this trial, of course, was not without its controversies. Chikatilo was held in a large cage throughout the trial, although this wasn't to keep the general public safe. This was actually to keep Chikatilo safe from the public and the victims' families. Chikatilo repeatedly withdrew his confessions, stating that they were obtained under duress or weren't included on the original indictment. The trial lasted almost 4 months, and on August 9th, final arguments were heard. The judge set an initial date of September 15th for himself and 2 official jurors to review the evidence and pass sentence, although this was postponed until October 14th.
When the court reconvened in October, the judge announced Chikatilo was guilty of 52 of the 53 murders he had been charged with, and he was sentenced to death for each count. He was also found guilty of the 5 counts of sexual assault. The judge read out the list of victims and then launched an attack on law enforcement and their mistakes, which had allowed Chikatilo to remain free until 1990. Although this was mostly aimed at special procurator Issa Kostayev rather than the local law enforcement. He claimed that Issa Kostayev was negligent and dismissive after Chikatilo was placed on a suspect list in 1987. The following day, on October 15th, Chikatilo was formally sentenced to death. He appealed, but all his appeals were rejected, and in late 1993, he made a last-ditch attempt to avoid death by appealing to the new Russian president, Boris Yeltsin, for clemency, but this too was rejected. On February 14th, 1994, Andrei Chikatilo was taken from his cell on death row in Novocherkassk prison into a soundproof room and executed with a single gunshot behind the right ear, and he's buried in an unmarked grave in the prison cemetery. And that is the story of Andrei Romanovich Chikatilo, the Red Ripper, the Rostov Ripper, the Forest Path Murderer, and the Butcher of Rostov.
Oh, wow. Boy. I don't have a lot to say here.
I have thoughts about the date of his execution, right?
Yeah.
Do they celebrate Valentine's Day in Russia? I mean, I assume they do now.
Do? Let's see. I've got info.
Oh, okay.
St. Valentine's Day came to Russia in the early 1990s, and it's a relatively new holiday. Although it is not observed as a public holiday, it is widely celebrated and remains one of the most popular romantic holidays in Russia. Surely, yeah. It is the romantic holiday.
So just the idea that this guy had to go and, you know, shoot a serial killer who'd killed, you know, 53 people, then had to go home and have sex with his wife that night, like.
But I think that if you were the guy who got to execute him, like, you'd be a pretty popular dude, you know?
Yeah, but depending on what gets you off, it'd either be, like, the worst sex or the best sex of your life.
Yes, that night. That's fair. Yeah. Yeah, glad he's dead.
Yeah.
And just, what an asshole. What a, like, monster, I think, yeah. Is the only...
Yeah, I agree. That's the only word that's really appropriate. Like, he was an absolute monster. He preyed on young people. He was the definition of a predator.
Yeah, absolutely.
He let the vulnerable in society take the blame for so many years.
Mm-hmm.
A man was executed for one of his crimes. First murder he committed.
His first one.
Yelena, I can't remember her surname. That guy Kravchenko was executed. Chikatilo was indirectly responsible for his death as well.
Oh, absolutely. The three or four men who took their own lives, like...
Oh, yeah, that as well.
So if you think about that, and then you think about all of the victims, and all of those victims' families or friends or love, like, the ripple effect of this one absolutely horrendous creature... Yeah. Is just massive.
Yeah, and not only that, his own family as well.
Mm-hmm.
Because, according to our reports, they had no idea about what he was doing, which was an aspect of the psychological profile.
That his wife wouldn't know.
Yeah, the wife wouldn't know, and she just, you know, let him get on with his life. You know, he went off traveling for work, and that was that.
Yeah.
And that's also why I haven't named his family, his children in this. They had to change their names because of the harassment.
Well, I was going to say, I don't doubt that, because especially in a situation like this where someone has murdered so many people for so many years, like, I'm sure there were an exponential amount of people out there who didn't believe that his family had no idea what was going on and just went after them. And, you know, unfortunately, there are a lot of instances where the people around these killers have no idea what's happening because they're just that good at hiding everything.
Yeah, I think sort of nowadays where we have a better idea of, like, psychological profiling and things like that, and, you know, just general popular media, true crime.
Mm-hmm.
All the media surrounding true crime, podcasts, TV shows, all the rest of it. I think people nowadays do understand that it isn't this weird monster that sticks out like a sore thumb. It's usually someone who blends into society.
Yeah.
Just easily.
Yeah.
But obviously 20, 30 years ago, people still weren't aware of that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
To the extent that we are, so, yeah.
Yeah.
It's just sad all around.
Yes. Definitely not a fun case, but...
No.
A good one to cover, I suppose.
Yeah.
Yes. So, with
go
that,
and
so...
find a fuzzy creature.
Yeah.
A cuddly toy. Anyone who you don't have to social distance from.
Go have a drink. Like, go watch some TV. Just, you know, do something happy. Yeah. Yeah. And if you've made it this far, good job.
Because at one point we almost didn't make it this far.
Yeah, so. We weren't so sure.
There was a few doubts, especially right in this second part, so.
Yeah, which is fair enough. So thank you everyone for listening. If you enjoy the podcast, despite its sometimes heavy nature, we would absolutely love it if you would give us a rating and a review. And if you would like to subscribe to us so you can automatically get notified when we have new episodes.
And we have some Halloween bonus content left to come.
Yes.
Left, don't we? I mean, yes. We've already given you a week of Halloween stuff, but...
There's more.
There's more coming before or on Saturday.
Yes. Yeah, so keep an eye out for that. If you want to talk about this case or any of the other things that we cover or, you know, anything at all, come check us out on social media. We are most active on Instagram, middle active on Facebook, and minor active on Twitter, but we're in all of those places, and you can find those links in the show notes or on our website. If you'd like to support the show monetarily, which you totally don't have to, but we love it if you want to, then you can head on over to our Patreon page, patreon.com/squaremileofmurder, and we have a bunch of different tiers with different perks and stuff and bonus episodes and all kinds of cool things, so go check it out if you're interested.
Thank you all for listening. We back in 2 weeks. We're having next week off.
Yes, it's been a big Halloween push for the last. So, I mean, we've been planning this for like a month and a half at this point. So
we're going to take next week off.
Our first vacation from the pod since we launched.
We'll see you in. This is too much. We'll see you in 2 weeks' time.
Yeah, in early November.
Yes.
And the world will be different, maybe. All right, but yeah, thanks for listening, and we will see you then.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.